everyone, and welcome back to the Strike and Ellicott Files, an unofficial podcast dedicated to all things Cormoran Strike and Robin Ellicott, as written by Robert Galbraith. My name is Kenz.
I'm Lindsay.
And I'm Pools.
And today we'll be continuing our reread of The Running Grave, covering chapters 64 of part 4 and chapters 65 and 66 of part 5 with our friend Kurt Schreier, who y'all will remember we've had on previously. He is an associate professor of English at the University of Missouri St. Louis, where he teaches courses on Shakespeare and early English drama. We are so happy to have you back, Kurt. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you. It's really great to be back. It feels like a long time, but we have some amazing chapters to talk about, and I'm looking forward to it.
Yes, we do.
So excited.
Please be aware, as always, that our discussion of The Running Grave will often reference the ending of this book, as well as the rest of the books in the series.
Before we start, this is your last reminder about our giveaway. Depending on where you are in the world, today is either March 14th or March 15th, and all submissions must be entered by the 15th, possibly today.
To enter the contest, make sure you send us an email, sefilespodcast@gmail.com, with the subject heading TSF100, and tell us your favorite moment from the podcast by 11:59 p.m. Pacific Standard Time on March 15th.
Which might be today.
And the right answer is my last appearance on this.
Yeah. Never.
Okay, so for our listener question today, we're actually going to give this over to you, Kurt. Do you have any questions for
sure.
us?
Yeah, I was wondering if there's a sort of minor character, not in the agency, that you are most hoping we'll see again in book 8, and why? I'll tell you why I was thinking about this, because for me, this character would be Al Rokeby. I know he's not a crowd favorite, but you know, if I'm reading book 8 and he's mentioned or we see him enter, I'm going to be really excited, because I think his return would sort of anticipate or herald the appearance of Johnny Rokeby.
Yeah.
And another reason I like Al is that I just enjoy seeing him look up to Strike. Mm-hmm. And Strike doesn't deny that he likes Al when Robin says as much, you know, at the end of chapter 5, The Running Grave. He says, well, vaguely, he's still pissed off at me because I wouldn't go to that bloody party for Rokeby. So again, I think Al's return in book 8 might also signify the beginning of a healing process for Strike and the other Rokeby children.
That would be interesting.
Maybe he could help with the final confrontation at the end of the book to have a silkworm parallel.
And yeah, we are going to have to see Rokeby at some point, right?
We'll be right eventually.
Yeah, I agree with all those points. And I'm always looking forward to a possibility of meeting Rokeby.
Yeah.
I feel like I have a lot of different answers for different reasons. Mm-hmm. So one is Ted, because I'm really curious about how he's doing. Wondering if we're in for some heartbreak or if Ted will say anything that will unlock something about Lita and her killer.
Yeah.
Linda, I'm looking forward to. I'm always looking forward to the Robin Linda showdown or resolution there. I don't know if it'll happen in the next book, but if she shows up, I'll be excited for whatever happens there. Mm-hmm. And then Ilsa, because we always get some good shippy content from our Captain Ilsa. So. Mm-hmm. And very much like a heart-to-heart between Strike and Ilsa or something like that.
Yeah, that would be... So we got the Robin-Ilsa heart-to-heart in Ink Black Heart. So I think now we're due the Strike and Ilsa heart-to-heart, right?
Poor Ilsa. Imagine if she's like hearing both of their sides and just like these two idiots. You would really feel for her if that happened.
Sometimes you do feel very bad for Ilsa that these two dummies are some of her best friends. How does she handle it?
I don't know.
Without wanting to smack them, because I would have lost my temper.
I guess she probably vents to Nick, so Nick hears a lot of it. Oh, maybe Nick will have heard so much, he's like, he'll just call Strike and like, look, mate, you need to do something about this because I can't take it anymore.
I can't do it. Oh, that's funny. You know what, Lindsay? Going from your Linda thing, I really want to see Martin again.
Oh, okay.
Because I'm really curious about the whole situation that's going on with Carmen.
Yeah.
I want the tea on that. I really do. And you know what? I've been feeling, I want to see how his and Robin's relationship is right now, because, you know, she was the good child of the family in contrast to his problem child, but she's been pushing against that so hard that now she feels like the bit of the black sheep of the family, right? And Martin is suddenly now in the I'm giving Linda more grandbabies position. It's shifting up the family dynamics, and I'd be really interested in seeing it. And at the same time, I'd love to see Stephen too, and hopefully Stephen interact with Strike again.
Yeah.
Yes.
Throw in Jonathan. I want to see if he got rid of that, what's her face? The vegan.
Courtney.
Thank you. Yes. Just an Ellicott family reunion. And then also Prudence.
Yes.
I loved her. I want more.
I think Prudence is probably on the top of my list too. Mm-hmm. Mainly because it's like, okay, we had this buildup for such a long time of Strike and Prudence are going to meet. They're going to talk for the first time. And then like we kind of jumped into their relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't really get to see a whole lot of them talking by themselves and, you know, having like a heart to heart sort of deal. And I'd like to see more of that. So yeah, she's definitely on the top of my list. Ilsa mm-hmm. also, of course. God, I'm trying to think of a third person I would want to hear from.
Vikas comes back from the dead.
Yes.
Yeah, I think we're all 100% on board for that. Please. Not as a zombie. That's a different genre. Although I have been for a long time saying it would be amazing if she just suddenly transitioned into the full-on zombie apocalypse. No one would be expecting it.
So this one might be slightly out of left field, but I can see how Katie's doing.
Oh, the cousin?
Yes, the one that said that Robin's going backwards.
The one who gave Hugh Jax Robin's address?
Yes. I want to hear again from her and see if maybe she's realized that she's made a few mistakes.
Yeah, I'd be down for that.
All right. Should we jump into our chapter?
I can't believe we're here.
The chapter 64. What happens in this chapter, Kenz?
I don't know. What could it be? Charlotte's found dead.
What?
I know. That was my same reaction. And then Strike has a moment of serious introspection at the St. John the Baptist Church. So the epigraph for this chapter, 9 in the third place, darkening of the light during the hunt in the south. One must not expect perseverance too soon. And that is from Hexagram 36, Darkening of the Light.
Okay, I have a small essay for this one.
Oh, I'm excited.
Yeah, let's hear it.
So this one stumped me a little at first, but I found it really touching the more I looked into it. The hexagram talks a bit about hiding away your own light during difficulties in order to prevail. It says that perseverance must dwell in inmost consciousness. So my cake deck says, the work should be done in secret, thus strength is reserved and future success is more likely. And my header deck says, when no one is looking, who are you? So this to me is talking about the way Strike handles Charlotte's death. It's very private and very personal, but not in the loner way that we might have seen from him in the earlier books where he just avoids everyone and everything, including his own thoughts. You know, he does do the processing and the introspection that is needed, but it's a private thing for him. And I think in this case, it's what he needed. Mm-hmm. In the actual Book of Changes, the part that comes right after this passage seems appropriate, even though it's not perfect. It says, while the strong, loyal man is striving eagerly and in good faith to create order, he meets the ringleader of disorder as if by accident and seizes him. Thus victory is achieved. But in abolishing abuses, one must not be too hasty. This would turn out badly because the abuses have been in existence so long. I feel like that could have been written about Strike and Charlotte's relationship. He seeks order, we know this, but he met the ringleader of disorder when he met Charlotte. It's a little bit flipped though, because instead of order seizing disorder and achieving victory, she seized him. You know, and then abuses being in existence so long. We all know that's true. He wasn't hasty about abolishing these abuses, but instead I think we're seeing him finally heal from these abuses that have caused him so much pain from Charlotte and from Leda.
I mean, you've written exactly what I would have said. Literally, even down to picking out and analyzing that same quote, because I had that in my clipboard ready to go. And then I come in here and wow, yeah, nice. Yeah. So absolutely agree. Yeah. The hexagram's about introspection in a time of darkness, about maintaining inner strength and enduring through that darkness. And like, yeah, I think you nailed it there.
Yeah, Strike and Charlotte's relationship has always been sort of on again, off again. There's constantly, we're seeing sudden and dramatic and violent changes to it. So I think you've made a really good point, Lindsay. Strike here is steady in the sense of he's sort of rock solid. He's sober-minded, emotional at some level, but measured, I think, and reserved. And as I read the phrase darkening of the light, for me, that sort of connotes death. And that phrase, the hunt in the south, suggests soul searching, you know, introspection, going inside and coming to terms with where he's at.
So the hunt in the south, soul searching, Kurt, I just looked it up. And in Chinese mythology, symbology, each cardinal direction is associated with an animal. You know what the south is? The phoenix for rebirth.
Oh my goodness.
Coming back from the ashes.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, technically it's the red vermilion bird, but multiple sources say that that's a phoenix. So, I mean, it might not be the rebirth phoenix in Chinese symbology, but when you put it in J.K. Rowling's world, and you refer to the South in a book that's all about the Chinese symbolism, I feel like that's significant in this chapter that the hunt is in the South.
Yeah.
Nice.
That's wonderful.
Okay, so I can't believe we're actually here. I don't know if there has ever been another chapter in the series that has felt as significant as this one does. I mean, yet.
Yeah.
Keyword.
I think that this is one of the chapters I've reread the most. It's up there with the rescue escape, Il Portico, and the ending for me. And I genuinely think that this is some of the most beautiful and powerful writing that Jo has ever done.
I agree.
All of her work. This stands out to me.
So we start the chapter with Strike waking up from a dream. And it says, he'd been dreaming that he was sitting beside Robin in her old Land Rover and exchanging anecdotes about drowning, which in the dream, both had experienced several times.
We talked about this being one of those in-book parallels between the two of them, lots.
Yeah, we have. And I'm never going to shut up about this one. So if it's not clear, the parallel here is that Strike is sitting beside Robin in the Land Rover talking about drowning in his dream. And then in a future chapter, Robin is the one drowning and her last thought is of Strike beside her in the Land Rover. I know we probably don't have to spell that out.
It's sweet to hear it anyway.
It's so sweet to hear it.
Yeah, it also feels like part of the magic soulmate connection that we see later when she knows he's there.
Yes, yes, yes. It is that spiritual connection, the mystical connection.
On the other hand, him having this dream, it does make sense because he had just been to visit the scene of two drownings and normally he's with Robin discussing a case. So it does make sense, but it absolutely is a soulmate connection.
Don't come in with your logic and your facts here to explain away magic.
No, I'm not. No. It's a soulmate connection.
It is. And God, if there's one thing in this book that is 100% guaranteed to get me in my feelings, it's when she does stuff like this to illustrate the profound connection that they share. It really does something to me.
Is it too much of a stretch to suggest that there's something here about how he's dreaming about talking to Robin about drowning, but Charlotte's the one dead in water? I don't really know what it would be, just throwing it out there.
I'm already in my Nutter Drawer era about the whole parallel between the baptism, the drowning, the dying in the bath. So I think you're fine. I think there's definitely something there.
I don't feel reassured.
You don't feel reassured? You don't want to be in my Nutter era with me? You don't want to make friendship bracelets about it? All right.
No, your Nutter era. Did you ever leave it?
I did not. And I never will.
Okay.
I wonder if you would indulge me a little Shakespeare nuttery here, because reading Strike's Dream, I'm reminded of one of Shakespeare's most famous sonnets. It's Sonnet 30. And listen, I'm not suggesting this was a source or an inspiration here, but I think it might shed some light on what Strike's going through here and sort of illustrate how the dream foreshadows the news of Charlotte's death. That is this dream itself before he reads his text. So Sonnet 30, when to the sessions of sweet, silent thought, I summon up remembrance of things past. I sigh the lack of many a thing I sought, and with old woes, new wail, my dear time's waste. Then can I drown an eye, unused to flow, for precious friends hid in death's dateless night, and weep afresh love's long since cancelled woe, and moan the expense of many a vanished sight. Then can I grieve at grievances foregone, and heavily from woe to woe tell o'er the sad account of four bemoaned moan, which I knew pay as if not paid before. But if the while I think on thee, dear friend, all losses are restored and sorrows end. Now, again, I don't want to make too much of this, but the sonnet is essentially a reflection on memories of pain and loss, of past suffering, and particularly the death of loved ones. But it concludes by finding solace in a dear friend whose presence brings those sorrows to an end. It's about endings and new beginnings, Pools, as you were saying, you know, that sort of baptismal experience. I think it illuminates Strike's dream of exchanging anecdotes about drowning with Robin sitting in the landy. We see in The Running Grave how he repeatedly feels the need for her presence to help him cope with and overcome what he's currently stressed about Bijou, but they've both been drowned repeatedly in romantic miseries. And as I know you want to talk about, Strike is also reliving another four bemoaned moan. And it's connected here with Charlotte's death. Namely, I'm thinking of the death of Lita. But right now, with each other together, all losses are restored and sorrows end.
Oh, that's lovely, Kurt. I admit that I'm not as good with Shakespeare as I should be. But this sonnet, I think you've explained how it fits really beautifully. And I'm thinking about how in the previous chapter, so Strike thinking about Robin, it wasn't ending his sorrows at all. There, thinking of Robin was primarily making him feel regret, sadness, you know, more depression. But then we move to this chapter and it's bookended with one, the talking to Dream Robin about the drowning. And then at the end, thinking about Robin and how he wants a good person for a change. It's the chapter in which that baptismal transformation takes place, and on a very suitable day, as I'll discuss later, it's St. John the Baptist's day when Charlotte dies. But prior to this momentous moment, he has been searching for a connection with Robin physically, right? Because we've seen him sit in her chair. We've seen him drive past the lion's mouth, and none of it has really worked, because what he needed to do was to clarify and understand the sort of spiritual, emotional, mental connection with her, soulmate connection, inside of himself. That's the connection he needed to accept in order to find that solace and peace when he's thinking about her. Yeah, I don't know if that makes sense.
It does. I think it ties in with what I was saying about the epigraph, that he needs to find this peace within himself first.
Yes, exactly.
By the way, when I was first reading this chapter or the book, I was reading it on Kindle, so I did not see the full page with the text and the headline that she was dead. Mm. So I just saw the text first.
Yeah. When you see seven different texts, all from people that Strike knew would be the ones to rush to tell him, that's not a good sign. Your heart was like, oh.
What happened? I was worried that it was something in the press, either to do with Charlotte's threats or Bijou. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until Fergus Robertson's text that said she left a note that I understood what was happening. And then my hand just shot straight over my mouth for the whole time. Just
So let's talk about the text that he got. So the first one is from Pat, where she says, her sister's just called. I said you weren't here. Hope you're all right.
This text, it feels so pat to me, because it is, it's practical. It's concise. This happened. I did this. Have this understated statement of concern. But knowing how Strike and Pat are with each other, you can sense how much she cares about him beneath the surface here. She's telling him she has his back. And Pat saying, hope you're all right to Strike, is like anyone else saying, like, I don't know. I love you. I'm here for you. Something much more demonstrative. It feels monumental for their dynamic for Pat to be texting him this.
Maybe this is there for all those Pat Strike shippers. I don't know.
Talk about the Nutter era. Oh,
yeah.
Oh, man.
What I find interesting about this text, though, is that Amelia called right away.
Mm.
Another reason I'm glad Strike was away, because I don't think it would have been good for him to talk to her that soon when it was so raw for her.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think she would have had time to process the note and realize she shouldn't have shown it to him.
No, that wouldn't have been a good experience for either one of them.
So at the level of sort of you're a novelist writing a novel and you want to kind of prepare your reader for this meeting of Amelia and Strike down the road, right? Yeah. You know, it's going to be a big scene. And so I can see mentioning her name here kind of plants that, ooh, how's that going to go down and create anticipation. But at the level of the characters, you say, you can see how like she's just read this awful letter and she would just sort of almost unthinkingly in all the emotions of the that she's feeling, just call.
Yeah. So the timeline, she probably would have gotten the note at some time the previous day, right? They would have just found out about it that afternoon. The police would have been and gone. She'd have gotten the note. Was she just waiting by the phone to call the agency as soon as it opened?
Yeah, because it was right away in the morning.
Right in the morning. He's not even up yet. And she's already called the agency like the second Pat sits down.
Yeah.
And I'm just thinking out loud here, this may not make sense, but is she angry with him? Is she blaming him? Has she internalized some of what Charlotte has accused him of and just needs a, where the hell is this guy? Like, let me talk to him.
It could be because we know she didn't like Strike. Charlotte's family had never liked Strike. I could see her calling to lash out before she's had time to process and think about it. I could see that happening.
Was it too much for you to pick up the phone and talk to her? This wouldn't have happened, kind of stuff.
The next text comes from Lucy and she says, Stick, I'm so sorry. I've just seen. It's awful. I don't know what else to say. Hope you're okay. Kiss, kiss, kiss.
This is also a very sweet message. I really relate to the part where she says she doesn't know what else to say, because what do you say when it's someone like Charlotte, who Lucy did not like, but she's still concerned for her brother?
Yeah, she handles it really well, though.
This text to me just feels like the new Lucy. You know, it's the running grave Lucy, not troubled blood Lucy.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, she's focused on her brother and being there for him. And that doesn't change how she feels about Charlotte, right? Mm-hmm. There's no love lost there, but that's not what's important now at this moment.
All right, so let's skip ahead a bit and let's do Polworth's text, because this was pretty funny. Bit of a fucker, this, did he?
Yeah, this endeared me to Polworth, which can be difficult to do, I admit. I think it's a combination of Strike being a bit surprised at the compassion, because Polworth hated Charlotte, but also it's a callback to when Strike lost his leg, as we see Strike point out. I might put this down as a Troubled Blood parallel, because we learn in Troubled Blood that Polworth said this exact same thing to Strike word for word when he lost his leg.
Also, if there was ever anything that was a bit of a fucker outside of getting your leg blown off, it's this.
Yeah. You know, as an aside, I just joked that it's difficult to endear me to Polworth, and I'm kind of realizing that that might not be true. There's a lot about him that would drive me nuts, and I definitely feel for Penny, but he's such a good friend to Strike and to Ted that I find myself forgiving a lot of those other things.
Yeah, I agree. And he's not eloquent.
No.
And this is how he's going to express himself, but it's also so characteristically funny, you know, a characteristically funny Polworth thing to say.
Yeah. How did you all feel when you read the headline that Charlotte was dead? Because I think I've said it before that this was the most shocking thing for me that should not have been. It was an expected shock.
I was not shocked. I was vindicated, because as I have evidence of in our predictions episode, I predicted this. The one time I'm right, I'm going to gloat. But apart from that, it felt inevitable, didn't it? It was instantly clear to me that this was always where the Charlotte plot was going to end. And callously, I'll admit, I was a bit relieved that he wasn't going to have to deal with her going to the press and spreading lies about him.
Oh, yeah.
Part of me was too. Like, oh, good. She can't go after Robin or talk to Fergus Robertson or anything.
I think we all felt that way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which feels callous, but I just have to remind myself she's not actually a real dead person.
Sure. And that was also a really awful thing for her to threaten to do.
Yeah.
And we're all Team Strike. So, yeah, I get it.
I remember there being a great many holy shits, because I remember, Lindsay, you had texted me. You were like, I just read 64. Holy shit. I'm like, oh, my God, because I was behind you at that point. And I was so nervous. I was texting. I was like, my hands are clammy. I'm so worried about what the fuck it is I'm about to read.
Yeah.
But yeah, then just like, bam, it was like, oh, my God.
It's one of the most exciting parts when someone's reading the book for the first time.
Yes. Oh, I love that.
Tell me when you get to chapter 64.
I love it. Yeah, I love that feeling of being ahead of someone and just waiting for them to get to a bit that you know they're going to absolutely lose their mind over. Peak reading experience.
Reading the article, I will say that I felt a little bit bad for this Landon Dormer guy, because they kind of publicly implied that the reason she killed herself was this arrest for assaulting him. That's got to suck a bit.
It does.
I don't know why I have this idea in my head that Landon Dormer is a bad person, because we get no information about him.
No,
other than that he's a billionaire.
Well, I mean, Strike does seem to be kind of the exception in her kind of crappy taste in men. So
yeah, maybe I'm just basing it on
Jayco.
That might be it. And that might be really unfair of me.
Yeah, we don't know anything about him.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, it's great that you're here for this, Kurt, because there's a Shakespeare quote in this article about Charlotte's death, and we would love to hear your take on it, where it says, "Death lies on her like an untimely frost upon the sweetest flower of all the field."
Okay, well, I'll put my professor hat on here for a second. This is absolutely one of my favorite lines in all of Shakespeare. In fact, as I recall, it's one of the ones that made me fall in love with Shakespeare in the first place. It comes from Act 4, Scene 5 of Romeo and Juliet, and it's spoken by Juliet's father when she is supposedly found dead in her bedchamber. She's not really dead, if you know the story, spoiler alert, but she has drunk a sleeping potion that was given to her by the friar. And the image he invokes here in his grief is just beautiful. It's exquisite. It's the image of, you know, picture this sort of fragile, budding little flower in the springtime that has been suddenly killed by an untimely frost and now will never live to ripen fully in summer. Untimely is one of those marvelous Shakespearean words. It means unseasonable or ill-timed, premature. And Shakespeare uses it as I recall, about a handful of times in Romeo and Juliet, deliberately so, because it beautifully captures the ill-timed and premature death of the two young lovers. But when you consider where the line comes from, there's an added, really heartrending poignancy to the use of this phrase by Juliet's father that I think is relevant, actually, to Cormoran here. And yes, I know this isn't Cormoran speaking. The last time that Capulet had spoken to his daughter, they were arguing. In fact, he was so angry with Juliet that the scene really borders on a domestic abuse. The last thing he had said to her was that if she refused to marry the man he had chosen for her, he hoped that she would hang, beg, starve, or die in the streets. It's a terrible thing for a father to say, right? And it just really reminds me of how painful the untimely death of Charlotte must be for Strike, who knows that he was arguing with her pretty much right up to the end, right? Albeit not as badly or as violently as they had used to do. So I just stand in awe of Joe's use of this line from Romeo and Juliet. It's masterful, it fits, and I kind of want to know what her favorite Shakespeare play is. Is it Romeo and Juliet?
Do you think she'd love the tragedies or the comedies?
Good question.
Because she loves a happy ending.
Yeah. And that, you know, when I think of her wit, even in, you know, in the midst of tragedy, of course, Romeo and Juliet is a play that's really funny. There's lots of humor woven into the tragedy.
You know, you're talking about the fact that this was the brother who said this.
Mm-hmm.
It makes sense that, so Juliet's father is saying this when it's too late, but really he was being awful to her, right? I feel like that's a lot of Charlotte's family too. Yeah, they're putting up this front, but we all know how her family was like, right? So it almost seems fitting.
Yeah. And let me say too, for them to put something, a decorous Shakespeare quotation, there's something off about it too. As beautiful and poignant as I do find it, it's covering up a lot of dark experiences.
I couldn't help but think about Jonathan Wace plagiarizing that poem about Cromer, which was mentioned in the preceding chapter again, to memorialize his wife's death. And Strike thinks it doesn't seem like truly grieving.
Yeah.
And then you compare that with the actor, Sasha, using Shakespeare's words here. And like you said, Lindsay, we know from Strike that Charlotte's family was, you know, madder and stranger than his own, riven with feuds and addiction. Yeah. You know, I'm sure that they did love her in a way, but like you, I can't help but sense a certain performative grief here. The use of someone else's pretty words to cover up this dark, complicated, painful truth.
Yes.
Just like Wace uses it to cover up his narcissism and lack of feeling.
Yeah, no, that I like that too. I love the ambiguity around it, surrounding it. We've had before in, was it in the previous book, right? Where they're talking about the use of Latin phrases that doesn't really show true intelligence or anything like that. Sometimes it's just a way of putting people down.
Slapping or impressing people.
Exactly. And so, yeah, I think this could be an entirely performative, done for the public consumption rather than expressive, true, heartfelt loss.
As far as your comparison to Strike, I like that it's also a contrast because, yes, they never stopped fighting, but unlike Juliet's father, Strike's last words to her were kind. He did wish her well.
You know, in a way, it was actually Charlotte who was speaking in Juliet's father's voice at the very end.
Mm-hmm.
She's the one threatening to destroy Strike because he wouldn't love who she wanted him to, herself.
Yeah.
Which actually makes the use of the quote comparing her to Juliet pretty ironic.
I do like Charlotte seeing herself as Juliet, though. You know, she killed herself for Strike, for love, I guess. Mm-hmm. But his love was already dead. He wasn't her Romeo.
Yeah, he definitely was not her Romeo.
No. It kind of makes me think of that line from Cuckoo's Calling where Strike thinks that Bluey was dead because he did sort of kill that part of himself. Now I'm about to go on a Bluey was a Horcrux tangent and that's dangerous.
Yeah, it's a little bit of her clinging on to him.
Yeah.
Interesting.
You know how last time when we talked about the article about Charlotte's arrest, there had been links to two stories about Charlotte in that article, and both of them were connected to Strike. I think the same thing is true for the pictures that are in this one. The first is her graduation picture, and Strike remembers that he saw this picture while he was stationed in Germany, and they had started seeing each other again.
This actually made me think of Career of Evil, where Robin cries herself to sleep amid the remnants of her and Matthew's shared past, because the biggest picture of them in their room was on Matthew's graduation day, with him in his robes celebrating an achievement she didn't get. Mm-hmm. And I'm not trying to fully articulate the parallel I'm feeling here, except that it's sort of a visual reminder for both of them, Strike and Robin, of who they were when they didn't know any better, to quote Robin from the end. It's a parallel between Corman and Robin's younger selves in their relationships with Charlotte and Matthew, summed up in both of these graduation pictures, one of them showing how Robin faded into the background, the other one showing how the facade and the complications and the hidden secrets of Strike's relationship with Charlotte.
And then the other one is the picture of Charlotte that Madeline had used in her jewelry launch, and obviously we know that's tied to Strike. I really don't know what my whole point is. It feels like it is showing their very long and shared history. Like what you were just saying, Pools, is very Robin and Matthew too.
Yeah.
This thought that he has about Madeline being glad her picture was used, totally believe it though.
Oh yeah. I kind of loved that Strike thought this actually, because he respected Madeline's business. The fact that she was dedicated to her work was something that drew him to her. I don't know where I'm going with this, except I like that he has a memory of something he liked about her.
I was thinking it was more like a negative thing, like, oh, you know, she's going to like this.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it will. But, you know, it is good publicity. But yeah, you're probably right. It is more of a judgy, oh, would she like that picture being
used? Yeah, that's how I read it.
I did too. Yeah.
Yeah, all right.
No, it just kind of shows that Strike's feelings are complicated here. I think you make a valid point. He did respect Madeline's business. It's very real that, you know, when you remember back, you connect the good and the bad.
Yeah.
And we can also sort of bring this back around to Strike's sincerity and coming to terms and facing his feelings and that sort of thing too. He's not glossing anything. He's not putting a nice face on it. He is doing soul searching. He's being honest with himself.
One part I have highlighted in my ebook is when it says Shock was battling a heavy sense of absolute inevitability. First, because like I said, it's exactly how I felt. But also, and I know he's about to make this connection himself, but I immediately thought of Leda here, because we all know before Strike even thinks it that he felt the same way about Leda's death.
Oh yeah, that was my immediate thought upon reading that line as well. It was just exactly like the aftermath of her death.
How sad that he goes through this twice, basically.
God, he does go through it twice.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And his reaction the first time was to run, to dive into something familiar. But this time,
he does not.
He decides it's time to stop doing that and dive into something new and kind of scary, but ultimately healthy.
You can see it when you go back and study this chapter, but it's all like these arrows just start pointing us to the end of the book. It's incredible.
Could he have stopped it happening? Yes, probably. But at what cost? Ongoing contact, escalating demands, and pleas to reunite with a woman who lived half addicted to her own pain. He'd long since abandoned the hope of any possibility of real change in Charlotte because of her adamantine resistance to any sucker but drink, drugs, and Cormoran Strike.
Kind of relate to Charlotte a little bit on that last one, not gonna lie.
Oh my God, yeah. Lindsay.
Relatable. She may be more on the deranged end of the spectrum, but she is indeed a badly wired lamp like the rest of us.
Yeah. Okay.
What are the different steps of the deranged spectrum?
Where do we fall
on it?
And
where do I fall on that? Because I'm concerned.
I feel like Charlotte is an outlier on the extreme end of deranged.
Yes.
Extreme derangement.
Where does Robin lie?
Robin's all the way on the other side.
She's wired perfectly.
This could possibly be a connection between the case and the personal in this book, because I think that Robin really feels this very deeply with Cherie. And maybe one of the reasons Strike has an easier time with it is that he already dealt with this feeling of, could I have stopped it? So he's kind of processed this feeling, maybe. I know that he also has a little bit more experience here and maybe just natural personality thing too. But I do think that we see both of them dealing with this at some point in this book.
It is a book about, like we've been talking about, there's a lot of suicide in this book. When you look at suicide as a self-destruction, in a way, just joining the cult of the UHC is a kind of self-destruction, right? So you have Carmen and Robin dealing with how they couldn't stop suicide, but you also have the family members of the people who have joined this cult dealing with the fact that they couldn't stop those people destroying themselves either, that they don't know how to save them or get them out, and dealing with the anger or the guilt.
Yeah, some people that join the cult, like, they hate themselves so much, and they're looking for something, some way to escape that. And then they get there and these, you know, charlatans are feeding that poison to them.
Strike leaves the hotel, and then as he's leaving, he spots the tower and then on a whim decides to go and find out what it is.
And right away, Charlotte is now speaking in his head. And Pools, I cannot stop thinking about your idea that they have to have her sitting there next to him in the show. People haven't heard this idea. I don't think they have, because you said it in a bonus episode that we haven't released yet, but it would be so good.
That is a brilliant idea.
I agree. That is totally brilliant. I love that. Honestly, I'm getting goosebumps just thinking about it, right?
Yes.
I do wonder, once he like gets inside the church, I wonder if they'll have him sit in the exact same spot that Joe was saying that he was. Oh. I bet they probably will. It was like third pew from the back or something like that.
Oh, yeah. That would be amazing. Yes. I can picture it so clearly in the adaptation, like close up on Tom, he's trying not to cry, closes his eyes, pull back out as he opens them to find Charlotte sitting next to him. Oh, he just has the conversation with her word for word. The showrunners would have to be fools not to do this. It's right there.
It would be so good.
I need it.
There's a bit just before this where Strike is thinking about the day that Leda died and how this felt similar, where grief was mixed with this guilty sense of relief since the worst had happened, so he didn't have to fear the worst anymore.
This, I think, is the reason he goes to the church on this day, because it doesn't really connect with Charlotte's loss unless you understand the connection there is between Charlotte and Leda. Mm-hmm. It says, finding out what that tower really was had nothing to do with Charlotte, yet had everything to do with Charlotte.
Oh.
We see in an earlier chapter that Strike does not like when people suggest this connection between Charlotte and Leda, but I just think it's so well done that in seeking truth that has to do with Leda, the tower, he is also freeing himself from Charlotte. And I think we see him finally understanding that connection.
Yeah, that's really good, because it's a symbol of fear.
It annoyed him because it was true.
Well, yeah.
Oh, 100%. I think we're always most annoyed when people call us out on shit that is 100% accurate.
Mm.
Like with me and you, Kenz, and the whole Catherine Kent situation.
You're never gonna get over that.
Surely never.
But it is that symbol of fear. I mean, it's also represents a symbol of mystery, the sort of unknowing, right? There's something about, you know, what ascending a tower means, you know, sort of in literature and that sort of thing too. But it has this kind of connoting. I mean, there's always like there's some mystery at the top of the tower. You gotta get there, you know, there's somebody there, kind of thing. And there's even a touch of it in Harry Potter. But anyway, I think the fear and the mystery and the desire to know, the search for truth and justice, they're all bound up there. And then most importantly, the serious man now is going to find the answer. He's not going to listen to the voice of Charlotte when she says, what are you doing? Why are you doing this?
You know, there's a tarot connection here with the tower. That was the one in Harry Potter, the lightning struck tower. But it signifies destruction, sudden devastation, the tower crumbling. But in that, there's room to rebuild something new always. So I think that's very fitting that he's seeking out a tower in this chapter when there is this sudden devastation.
He wasn't a little boy anymore, vaguely threatened by the watching tower, even though there were far more things to worry about closer at hand, with his mother out of sight in the woods and predators all around him. Nor was he the 19-year-old who'd fallen in love with Oxford's most beautiful student, too dazzled and disarmed that she seemed to love him back to see her clearly.
Honestly, you saying this, Kenz, I feel like the rest of this episode could just be us reading this entire chapter out loud, like audiobook style, because it's so good. It's so beautiful.
Everybody needs to hear it.
How do you even say anything about it when it says it all right there?
Why bother to summarize it when she says it so beautifully?
Just read it out. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I love this quote so much. It is so beautiful. And I feel like it really sets it up perfectly for this bit coming up about forgiving his past self and starting to connect those ideas about Leda and Charlotte.
I'm fascinated by the way he thinks about that moment where he first met Charlotte, contrasted with the way we've seen him think about that moment in the past. Because in Cuckoo's Calling, he thought of that in terms of the mythic. So she was Helen of Troy, and he carried her off in triumph. And later when he realized she'd engineered the whole thing, the memory still hadn't lost its sense of magic for him, right? But here the emphasis seems to be that he finally realizes just how young he was and how much
delusion there really was that he'd never saw through, even after he realized what she'd done. He admits now that he didn't see her clearly, whereas in Silkworm, he was still defiantly saying that, yeah, maybe he was delusional, but he still saw and loved the real Charlotte. But now he's finally actually grasping the truth about their relationship and his history that he has never seen clearly before.
It's just making me think of the Q&A we did last time about Strike getting older and wiser. Yeah. You just don't realize how young 19 is at 19.
God, it's so young. Mm-hmm. Little babies. I mean, Kenz, you were just 19, so you know.
Oh my God.
That's what it feels like sometimes.
I'm just teasing you. Oh, you don't realize until you're on that middle age that you're like, oh my God.
I'm just going to say, hold my beer.
There was a part of my brain that was so excited about Strike getting to this church just because it was one of the most exciting and curious headers that we got. Mm-hmm. Kurt, I think when you were on before, we talked a lot about this header and we had lots of ideas. I definitely remember us talking about the possibility of Strike and Robin passing notes in this church. You weren't too far off with that.
Right. Well, we speculated the church might be a drop location where messages would be exchanged. And that isn't what happened. But I nevertheless would say there are, in a way, messages being exchanged. I mean, here we've been talking about them. They're kind of metaphysical in their content. But I think I would also still not back off and risk even a bolder claim. This is absolutely, as we've been saying, a pivotal moment. And I don't think Strike would ever have been able to reach the point of openly declaring his love for Robin, as he's going to do at the end of this book, chapter 136, without this pivotal moment of healing and acceptance, of confronting and facing these questions and listening to and responding to Charlotte's voice.
I think you're absolutely right. This moment was crucial in getting to that place because he needed to be truly honest with himself and accept the things he'd been denying for a long time. He is exchanging messages with himself via imaginary Charlotte. Too bad we didn't get that hand-holding that we hoped for.
Yeah.
And peace be with you. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Too bad. Oh,
but what we got was so much better, though.
Yes, okay. We did get hand-holding.
For 5 minutes.
I was going to say, we don't get that hand-holding, but we do get.
See, we weren't too far off.
Right.
We were just, you know,
we were so
wrong
close.
About the details.
Call it basically right. You know. Basically sure. Correct.
Sure. Yeah.
We knew there would be handholding.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was also exciting just to read the description of inside because Google Maps lets you look all around inside this church. So it felt a little familiar to me because I had done that. I could picture everything. Like you said, Kenzie, Joe even told us where Strike sits. So we just had everything we needed to really picture the scene.
And the church itself in this narrative has some serious significance as like a building. Bear with me. So the physical description of it, he notes the flint rubble facing. We've just seen him have very negative associations with that flint rubble because of Leda. It's the farmhouse she disappeared into, right? Mm. It represents neglect and danger and fear for him. But it's in this flint rubble building that becomes a sacred space that he's finally coming to terms with that past and accepting the pain and recognizing how it shaped his life. He's facing his demons here that are represented in the physical landscape of his living nightmare of a childhood. Mm-hmm. And then we have the church's name. It's St. John the Baptist Church.
Yeah.
And then yesterday, the day Charlotte died, was St. John the Baptist Day, June 24th. And we know she did die on the 24th because she'd called him at 1 minute to midnight on the 23rd. So she did die in the early hours of the morning. So this can't be a coincidence, right?
No, of course.
Charlotte dies in water in the bathtub on the day of St. John's nativity. But there's nothing about the baptismal rebirth here. There's no repentance of sin in preparation for judgment. Her last acts are to lash out in anger at her family and at Strike. Mm-hmm. But it is that anti-baptismal death that leads Strike to this place, the St. John the Baptist Church, where he does undergo that rebirth.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's all just pointing to the big neon sign that this is Strike's moment of renewal and rebirth.
We thought he was getting that in Troubled Blood with all the water, but that was just a precursor.
What you're talking about with Charlotte dying with no repentance, it reminded me of when Harry sees that creepy baby Voldemort at King's Cross.
Oh my God, Charlotte's the creepy baby?
And then he comes back and he tells Voldemort, he says, try for some remorse, but he won't do it. I'm not saying Charlotte is Voldemort. I'm not,
but
I was thinking it too. Yeah, Lindsay, I'm with you. Totally. Yep.
It's also significant dates. Charlotte also dies. So St. John the Baptist Day is also Midsummer. The 23rd, 24th is traditionally celebrated as Midsummer, even though technically the solstice is like the 21st or something. It's the shortest night of the year, the moment where the wheel of the year turns and the days begin to grow shorter and the nights grow longer. Although I don't know what that means for this.
Well, yeah, I won't go down a Shakespeare path again for the third time here.
But Midsummer Night's Dream.
Yes, right. Yes. So there are associations with, let me just cut it short and say that as you move from the shortest night of the year and into sort of the height of the festive season, it's marked by festivity, by celebration. And in the Shakespearean tradition, then, you know, love comes out. True love comes out of that chaos. Those middle acts of Midsummer Night's Dream, it's so chaotic that the character of Puck, Robin Goodfellow, has to say, turn to the audience in Act Three and say, I've got this. I'm paraphrasing Shakespeare here.
Yeah.
I've got this. Yes, I know this seems all confusion. And then he says, Jack shall have Jill, not shall go ill. And so he's saying, this is a comedy. There is romance and love coming.
What if Strike and Robin are Theseus and Hippolyta? Because Theseus was the hero who slayed the Minotaur, king of Athens. He was raised by his mother, found out about his father's identity and went off to claim his birthright as king, slayed the Minotaur, did all kinds of stuff. Hippolyta, queen of the Amazons, very badass, wed Theseus. The whole play is to celebrate their love, and and the chaos comes from it, right?
Are you ready for some next level stuff here?
Yes.
Hippolyta's first lines in the play evoke her past as the queen of the Amazons. But this is what she says. 4 days will quickly steep themselves in night. 4 nights will quickly dream away the time. There we have dreams again, right? And then the moon, like a silver bow, new bent in heaven, shall behold the night of our solemnities. So that image of a bow being bent like a huntress. Artemis. She's a huntress. She is. Yeah, you got it right. That connection with Artemis is kind of fascinating. Now, I would need to do some more with this, but anyway, I'm just providing you some ammunition.
This is a blog post. But yes, the connections. And for, I know it's not actually 4 days until they reunite, but it's a month, which is one moon. And yeah, the Artemis thing.
It's really interesting.
But yeah, love. Love and chaos. Puck has it. Who's Puck then in this case? Polworth? He's a bit puckish.
Bit of a pucker. That was a very lame dad joke. Yeah. Sorry.
We love dad jokes.
Anyway, I really love his thoughts about Joan here. It says that while he doesn't believe people he loved and admired did, and that her belief in certain forms and structures had provided a jarring contrast to his mother's disdain for boundaries and every form of small town respectability. I don't think it's a coincidence that he's thinking about Joan while all of these thoughts of Leda are with him. I believe that we talked about this during Troubled Blood, where if Charlotte is a reflection of Leda, maybe Robin is more Joan, the conventional thing that he didn't think he wanted, but is now embracing and realizing that there's a lot of good in that. I don't know. This moment just makes me Team Joan all over again.
Oh, yeah. Team Joan forever, right?
Yes.
It would have been so interesting to hear her thoughts on all this, even given the fact that she thought that Charlotte was nothing short of a she-devil. It would have been interesting to hear.
So this is when the man comes out in a strike if everything's okay. I really liked this guy. Very respectful, thoughtful, and caring. He checks in but leaves him alone. Great. Mm-hmm. That guy gets an A+ from me.
Yeah, this guy is more respectful and thoughtful than honestly most people in these books.
Yeah.
Is the only other member of the clergy that we've met in these books Una from Troubled Blood?
Yeah, I think so.
Jo is way nicer to vicars than she is to accountants. Way nicer.
All right, so let's get to the conversation that he has with Charlotte in his head, because that's really what we're here for, right?
Oh, yeah. There are definitely times where Strike might be an unreliable narrator. I don't think that this is one of those times. I think that everything that happens in Strike's head here is absolutely true to Charlotte.
Absolutely. I mean, we've been shown over and over that Strike predicts what Charlotte will say and do. He knows her patterns of behavior. I'm wondering, are we seeing like some sort of opposite echo between Robin's imagined conversations with Strike keeping her sane and grounded, and Strike's imagined conversation with Charlotte finally bringing him to truth and understanding?
I mean, I know that Charlotte isn't Strike's touchstone, but this still feels like a parallel to me.
Yeah, they're both having conversations in their head that
are helping them.
This actually reminds me, Anna Kiara said to me the other day that Strike speaking to Charlotte in his head reminded her of Harry speaking to Dumbledore in his head at the end of Deathly Hallows. Of course, these are different, but the whole idea of course, this is happening inside your head. Why on earth should that mean it is not real? It feels very appropriate because I do think it's quite real for Strike, not just because, as I just said, I think it's true to Charlotte, but in both books, we have Strike and Harry walking away from these conversations, knowing what they need to do next. Mm-hmm. And it is real for Strike because it brings him healing. So I think it's a really good parallel.
Oh, yeah. He's destroying that Charlotte Horcrux. I love that.
Charlotte is simultaneously nice. Dumbledore and the creepy Voldemort baby.
Amazing.
At the same time.
She contains multitudes.
She does. Yes, she's multitudes.
Oh, wow.
She is legion to make
legion.
It
legion.
Yeah. I'm not suggesting Charlotte is any of these things. I'm just saying that this is, you know,
right.
I see it. I was glad to see that while Strike knows Charlotte's take is that he's the only one who could have saved her, he also very clearly understands that it's not his job. I'm not sure he was there in troubled blood. So it was really nice to see.
Yeah, totally. There was still a part of him in that book that still felt responsible for her well-being enough to get someone there to save her, which was a lovely gesture. But I feel like in hindsight, especially now that we're a couple books on now, it makes it more obvious that she still somewhat had a hold on him even then.
And then, of course, he mentions her kids, which was really sad that she should have stayed alive for them. I think this is another way Leda and Charlotte are connecting in this chapter, because Strike thinks about Leda leaving her two children unsupervised and then hear how Charlotte has left her two children. The you should have done, you know, XYZ for your kids is strong with both Charlotte and Leda.
It really is. And it's another example of just how seriously Strike takes the responsibility of parenthood. He doesn't want to be a father. We know that, but it's precisely because he so well understands and values the weight that being a good parent places on you.
So next, Strike thinks, I gave you everything I had to give. I put up with shit I'll never put up with again. Robin's a saint, is she? How boring, said Charlotte, now smirking at him. You used to like a challenge.
I like this bit a lot. First, him acknowledging that he'll never put up with it again. And of course, he won't have to. I feel like this kind of speaks to what we were talking about before with him acknowledging that this was abuse.
You mean he'll never have to tell Robin to not like throw shit at his face during the argument? What a novel concept.
I know. Second, I love that even this version of Charlotte goes straight to Robin and that Strike doesn't question why she did.
Yeah, nor does he deny it. He knows she knows.
Yeah. When Charlotte says you used to like a challenge, it's so ridiculous to me because Robin has challenged Strike in ways that just having bad behavior could never do. Do you know what I mean? Just by being herself and by being his friend and partner, she has challenged him to change by never really asking him to.
And that's the funniest part of this whole thing, really. And Strike talks about it at the end whenever he's meeting up with Amelia, that Charlotte thinks that he fell in love with Robin because she hero worships him. She's obedient and doesn't challenge him. But literally none of that is true at all. And in fact, it's the exact opposite. And yeah, I think you're absolutely right. She does challenge him just by being herself to be a better detective, to be a better person. And he does the exact same thing for her without ever really trying to.
I would just add too, since I'm in late into this reread of The Running Grave, these chapters after Robin comes back from the farm and, you know, as they're continuing with the case, the two of them argue so much. So yeah, this notion that she's hero worshiping is bollocks. And through it, it's healthy. It's vivid. It's dynamic. It's they're being real and honest with each other. It's wonderful to see.
We've said so many times that we love every single time Robin and Strike have an argument because it pretty much always pushes them. It's constructive. It always pushes them to look at the other person's side or consider their own side and like grow.
Especially when you see Robin not want to have arguments with Murphy because she wants to avoid it, but she never does that with Strike.
It's not worth the effort.
They both value what the other thinks. There's no condescension towards the other person.
Yeah.
And that's the framework for a good, healthy argument and therefore relationship.
Next, he thinks, she's not a saint any more than I am, but she's a good person. And now, to his anger, he felt tears coming. I want a good person for a change, Charlotte. I'm sick of filth and mess and scenes. I want something different.
Okay. When I say I died,
Yeah, I might cry. Yeah. I might cry.
You might have to take a moment of silence for this part because, wow, this is huge.
I think that the she's not a saint any more than I am might just be my favorite part of this because, yeah, neither Strike nor Robin are saints. He's not putting her on a pedestal. He's not inventing an image of a perfect Robin that doesn't exist. He sees and knows the real Robin in a way that he for so long failed to do with Charlotte. Robin and Strike are both human beings with flaws. They both struggle with some things. They both need to grow and develop as people, but they help each other grow because at their core, they are both good people who have shared values and principles. So no, she's not a saint and neither is he, but she is a good person. And so is he.
And the fact that he feels tears coming to his eyes when he thinks about how he wants a good person for a change. I don't know if anybody has any coherent thoughts on that because that just like hits me right in the gut.
Yeah. Same. Just lots of screaming and crying from the emotions closet.
Screaming, crying, throwing up.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Throwing up.
Yeah, because of all the emotions.
Yeah, okay.
Notice that the two sentences that come after the tears are, I want, I want. Well, yes, there's, I'm sick of Phil. But still, it's him, what? I mean, he's asserting himself. He's being honest. He's working through. He's not running away.
Oh, I really want Robin, I want sentences, yes. Please. Oh. We've seen Strike think about what he wants, that he loves Robin. Mm-hmm. But this killed me in a way that hasn't before because it's like he's saying he wants something different, but at the same time, he's already found it and he knows what it is.
Oh, yeah.
Next, imaginary Charlotte says, would Robin kill herself over you? Of course she wouldn't. She's got more bloody sense.
I'm suddenly back at the Romeo and Juliet quote, right? Because Charlotte is kind of setting herself up as Juliet here. The pinnacle of love and romance, killing herself for him. More powerful than anything else. And Strike's looking at that and saying, those are two kids in a really messed up situation who made terrible choices. I don't want to be Romeo in your tragedy.
Yeah.
I want to be What's-His-Face in A Midsummer Night's Dream.
Yeah, that's right.
Demetrius or whatever. Lysander, I can't remember.
And Lysander and Demetrius, yes.
But yeah, he doesn't want to be that tragic figure because it's not actually what one should be aiming for in one's life, really. It's a good play, but this is reality, Charlotte.
Charlotte then continues, everything we had, everything we shared, and you want someone sensible? The Cormoran I knew would have laughed at the idea of wanting someone sensible. Don't you remember? Suns rise and set, but for us, there's one brief day, then one perpetual night. So kiss me 1,000 times.
I love the way Robert Glenister reads Charlotte's voice in this scene. It's so taunting and menacing. It's really good.
It is.
Also, I know this is not what I should be thinking about right now, but I am going to need Strike to quote poetry to Robin at some point. I think we've all agreed before that Strike is romantic. We see it in subtle ways with Robin so far, but the good memories with Charlotte really show it too.
Mm-hmm. Oh my God. Don't remind me that we have yet to see Strike at his most romantic because I don't think that we're going to survive it.
No.
Hey, by the way, that quotation, suns rise and set, but for us, there's one brief day, then one perpetual night. So kiss me 1,000 times. That was written by the ancient Roman poet Catullus, who was known for his erotic and sexually explicit poetry. But it's the perfect poem for Strike and Charlotte's relationship because the speaker is saying to his lover, forget about what other people say and think, let's be together, right? And in that, it's what's called a carpe diem poem, the carpe diem tradition, bidding the lover to seize the day and usually sleep together before age and death catch up to us. So it's a seduction. And that's what Charlotte's doing right here. It urges the exchange of the little death, la petite mort, of sexual orgasm instead of the final perpetual night of death. But now in this place here, it's bitterly ironic. However much she taunts him about how he used to be when they were young, they can never go back and Charlotte is never coming back.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you, Lindsay, that I need some poetry for Robin from Strike, but it's got to be something other than Catullus because that was a him and Charlotte thing. And I'm sure he can draw from a different well because we know he's a really well-read guy. And what you said, Kurt, just now about this specific line in this poem and its meaning, it actually made me think about John Donne because it felt so familiar to the flea, but this landmark in this, how little that which thou deniest me is, right? In that poem, it's a man begging a woman to sleep with him. And he's using the argument that the since this flea right here has bitten both of them and mingled their blood, they're already married. So what harm is it going to do? She might as well sleep with him.
Yeah.
And then she crushes the flea, which is savage and hilarious.
Yeah.
I guess my point with this is that I would be really, really on board with Strike quoting some John Donne at Robin, mm-hmm. because talk about romantic and sexual poetry, very much so. But it has a different vibe than Catullus, and I think it would work for Strike and Robin. So
the last bit of this conversation that Strike has with Charlotte, it reminds me a little bit of the last time they actually spoke. Here in his head, he's saying that he still wishes that she would have lived. It just reminds me of that phone call where he wishes her well and speaks to her with truth, but also kindness in the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he does.
I feel like the last few paragraphs, just they have to be read. There's no other option.
Yeah.
Like we were saying earlier, these next few bits are some of the most beautiful things I think that Joe has ever written.
Mm-hmm.
He opened his damp eyes again to stare at the cross on the altar. He might not believe, but the cross meant something to him nonetheless. It stood for Ted and Joan, for order and stability, but also for the unknowable and unresolvable, for the human craving for meaning and chaos, and for the hope of something beyond the world of pain and endless striving. Some mysteries were eternal and unresolvable by man, and there was relief in accepting that, in admitting it. Death, love, the endless complexity of human beings. Only a fool would claim to fully understand any of them.
I wrote something in my ebook a long time ago, so I just put this in here. So I said, he went to the church, not knowing it was a church, to solve the mystery of this tower, which was a symbol for him of fear and uncertainty, something that he gained in his childhood from Leda. And he carried that with him into adulthood. And we've seen how that has presented itself in his romantic relationships. But what happens in this church is he drops all of that. All of those fears he hasn't wanted to face are torn down and shattered once he finally willingly approaches it and takes its power away. He lets it go and embraces the other symbol he finds there, the cross, which for him represents structure, safety, family, love, all of the things he's been afraid of, he is now embracing. And I see this as kind of what I was talking about earlier, where embracing Joan and what she stood for also means embracing what he wants with Robin, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I really like that. It does. And, you know, it's in stark contrast to all that phony spiritual ladder bullshit proposed by the UHC, right? Strike is ascending here. If you remember Cuckoo's Calling, he escapes in drink. He drowns his emotions. But that's not what he's doing here. Like you said, does he tacitly admit the possibility of an afterlife here? I have my doubts, but something incredible happens. He's driving toward the distant tower. And we're reminded that, quote, his one unfailing refuge had been to resolve mysteries, to scratch his persistent itch for the truth. But when he's in the church here, what do we read? Some mysteries were eternal and unresolvable by man. And there was relief in accepting that, in admitting it. So I guess what I'm saying is Strike becomes the superior man by maturely confronting his grief and loss. Yes, but also by allowing for eternal and unresolvable and unsolvable mysteries, including love. And again, I think this is going to bear fruit in the final chapter. By facing and processing his grief, he will subsequently be prepared to meet Charlotte's sister. And out of that conversation, he'll take that risk, like the trapeze artist, of telling Robin about his feelings. To wrap up and put it back in terms of the cross and Christianity here, he is experiencing a kind of dying and rising.
Yes, I agree with all of it. As far as Strike admitting the possibility of an afterlife, I'm glad you mentioned this because I was thinking about it too. There were a couple of moments later on in the book that did make me think it was possible that his thinking shifted slightly. Like I said a couple episodes back, I don't think that religion plays a major theme in the books overall. But since I do see it in this particular book, I think that it could go hand in hand with the themes of spirituality and admitting possibilities. So I think it's an interesting question. As for your second point about the cross and Christianity and Strike having a dying and rising here, absolutely agreed. We've talked about this scene a lot as being a baptism. There's a heavy theme of baptism in this book, of rebirth and change. And I don't think it's a coincidence that this happens in a church called St. John the Baptist, as we've already said. So while I don't think that that's what's happening inside Strike's head and heart, the cross means something different to him. I think that these are signs for the reader that Strike is basically being baptized in this scene. All of the symbolism is there. He's a new man, still just as sexy, maybe even more so.
Which is incredible, really. Who knew it was possible?
Wow.
Spoiler alert, it's us. We knew.
Lindsay, the speed at which you transitioned from baptism to sexy has given me whiplash. That was a quick whoop.
What can I say? It's a gift. It's a talent.
An incredible segue, honestly.
It clearly is.
Dear listeners, this is the TCEF content that I have shown up for.
It wouldn't be TCEF if we weren't bringing up how sexy Strike is every three paragraphs. You know?
Exactly. And as he sat in this humble old church with the round tower that lost its sinister aspect when seen up close, he looked back on the teenager who'd left Leda and her dangerous naivety only to fall for Charlotte and her equally dangerous sophistication, and knew definitively for the first time that he was no longer the person who craved either of them. He forgave the teenager who'd pursued a destructive force because he thought he could tame it and thereby right the universe and make all comprehensible and safe. He wasn't so different from Lucy after all. They both set out to refashion their worlds. They'd just done it in very different ways.
You all know one of my favorite things about this book is Strike and Lucy. So I love that he thinks this here and realizes how similar they are. I think it's really going to bring them closer for him to have this understanding and be helpful for him in regards to his own self-awareness and the things that he's been doing to cope. But also, I think this is where Strike maybe acknowledges the connection between Leda and Charlotte.
Mm-hmm. And not only that, but that he knows definitively that he is not the person who craves anything like either one of them anymore. That is huge.
I know. I think Strike forgiving himself is one of the most beautiful things in this book that I didn't expect. Robin said something similar in the final chapter when she says that we have to forgive who we were when we didn't know any better. This actually makes me think that when Strike thinks that going to this church isn't about Charlotte, but it's all about Charlotte, I think the same thing can be said about Robin. It's also not about Robin, but all about Robin, in the way that he is acknowledging the past by also acknowledging what he wants his future to be.
Beautiful.
I just really see a connection between this chapter and the last chapter, particularly when it comes to letting go of the past and past mistakes. And that's exciting for me when it comes to Robin, because it all kind of just plays into what I'm hoping for and expecting for Robin coming up. Her saying that we have to forgive who we were when we didn't know any better, the things she doesn't know in that moment that she's about to know. I'm like, okay, Robin, forgive yourself for the mistake of marrying Matthew, for the mistake of keeping this relationship with Murphy going. And now you know better. Now you know Strike loves you. So what are you going to do?
We got to forgive ourselves for her, who we were 2 weeks ago when we said, I love you. Not just 19 years old, but forgive yesterday's self. Today is a new self.
I mean, but she's saying when she doesn't know any better, and she doesn't know then.
Joe puts in enough qualifiers at that moment, too, when he says, I love you, and she automatically responds. We're given all kinds of reasons as to why she's done that.
Right.
And she's going to have to come to terms with that and forgive herself for it.
This is making me think of the song that ended the first season of Strike, the Cuckoo's Calling, the wish that I knew what I know now.
Yeah.
Very apropos.
My God, what if Robin stops saying, I love you too, to Murphy after the whole...
I hope she does.
Me too.
I can understand her saying it the first time, but Robin, sweetie, baby girl.
It would be going right back to Matthew kind of things. She's got to.
She has to realize that it's not, she's a kind and compassionate person. This isn't fair to Murphy.
Right.
For Murphy's sake, she should break up with him. I'm going to frame it to her that way to try and get through to her.
I like how you're appealing
as if
to
I
a
can
fictional
text
character.
Robin. Yeah, I'm like, let me text Robin. Let me tell her what she's got to do in a way she'll understand. That'll fix everything. We're going to have to rely on Ilsa to do it for us.
While we're being absurd and addressing fictional characters, Robin, I will be okay with if you just blame Strike in that moment and get angry and blame Strike at that moment where you can't respond to Murphy's I love you. And you just want to blame Strike there out loud or in your head. Yeah. I'm fine with that. You just need to know that.
We haven't talked about how we need book 8 yet.
Soon, please.
So we're getting to the end of the chapter here.
Yes.
If he was lucky, he had half of his life to live again, and it was time to give up things far more harmful than smoking and chips. Time to admit to himself he should seek something new, as opposed to what was damaging but familiar. The kindly sheep-faced man had reappeared. As he made his way back down the aisle, he paused uncertainly beside Strike. I hope you've found what you needed. I have, said Strike. Thank you.
I think this is the moment where he knows he can't just sit around and wait to see what happens with Murphy. He's ready.
Mm-hmm. All or nothing, baby. And he's decided he wants it all.
He's found what he needed. The courage.
This might be a weird place for this, but I know that there are theories out there online that either Strike or Robin will die at the end of the series. And normally I wouldn't bring it up, but we have been sent some emails about this asking for our opinion. So I'm happy to give mine. The reason I feel like it fits well here is the line, if he was lucky, he had half his life to live. I think that this also really connects, and maybe if you stretch it, is a troubled blood parallel with Strike wondering who will be next to him when he's 80. Mm-hmm. And you know what? Sure, let's go with that, because both things imply to me that he and Robin are growing old together, you know?
Yeah, I absolutely think that's what this is pointing to as well. You know, mm-hmm. the whole till death in sickness and in health, for richer, for poorer, the whole kit and caboodle.
Yeah. So my opinion on this, if I'm ranking things that I think are possible or things that I'm worried about, this is at the very bottom of the list. Yeah. It's right there with all the pregnancy theories. And ultimately, for the same reason, I just don't think that that's the story we're being told. I think that these books are about healing and becoming who you're meant to be, pursuing justice, finding love. I don't think a tragic twist at the end fits in with all of that. That's just my opinion. People often use Harry Potter to counter this argument and say that, well, people died in Harry Potter. My response to that is always, one, Strike and Robin aren't in a wizarding war. And two, the main characters in Harry Potter did not die. They have a pretty picture-perfect happy ending. Probably the most happily ever after they could have had. And personally, I loved it. So No, I don't think it's going to happen. I know that probably won't stop the theories, but if it can ease anyone's mind, that's great. I just genuinely don't think twice about this.
Yeah, me neither. This has never been a serious worry for me, because killing one or both of them off would kind of defeat the purpose of having them both healing and becoming the best versions of themselves together. And not to mention, it just seems unnecessarily tragic. I mean, that's not to say that there's not more deaths coming aside from the remaining victims, but I think that Robin and Strike are not on that list.
I fully agree with both of you. I'm not worried about it. And you've explained why perfectly. And Kenz, I think you nail it when you say that it's unnecessarily tragic, because these books aren't tragedies. They are moving, the trajectory here is moving from broken to whole, you know, from murder to justice. They're about growth and healing, like you said, Lindsay. And yeah, they take steps back sometimes because it's about cycles, but the ultimate trajectory is always towards a place of wholeness and peace. And it would make no sense for the structure that we've seen so far to just be completely smashed apart and upended for the sake of, let's be real, cheap shock value, right? I think Jo has more integrity as a writer than that. I don't think she just does shock for shock's sake. I think she has a purpose with what she writes, and we can see the purpose looking at where we have gone so far.
Definitely.
Well, I hope we did that chapter justice. I know everyone's been waiting for it for a long time.
I just want to sit. I want to put the chapter in a bath and sit in it, but with bubbles and a candle, and just soak in it, which makes sense.
Totally. Let's get to part five. We have a part five epigraph. Above fire, below the lake, the image of opposition. Thus, amid all fellowship, the superior man retains his individuality. And that's from hexagram 28, opposition. I really like the idea of the superior man retaining individuality. Of course, we said before that these part epigraphs we think are both Strike and Robin, that there's the superior man, and it's fitting. They're both going through some struggles here where it might be easy to lose yourself a little, and they're both facing opposition. So in this part, we see Tayo becoming a little bit more suspicious of Robin, and Becca tries to frame her with the fish pendant. And Strike is still dealing with the Bijou drama and the paper saying that he illegally bugged Hanbold's office. So all of this opposition, they're both facing, but they stay true to themselves and they get through it.
Yeah, definitely. I agree. It's a short part, but for being so short, there are a lot of different clashes with people here. And you didn't say it, but Strike and Midge get into it over Dasha in this one too.
Looking forward to it.
Can't wait. That's going to be fun to record. But the advice that this hexagram gives is, here the important thing is to avoid mistakes. We must not try to shake off these evil men by force. This would give rise to real hostility. We must simply endure them. They will eventually withdraw of their own accord. And I think that they both do a pretty good job of enduring and avoiding mistakes here and not acting super rashly. They act, but not in a way that draws fire. The one dangerous moment in this part is Robin pushing Will, which appears in the moment to backfire on her. But in the end, it wasn't entirely a mistake, because Will does have that goodness inside him, which speaks to another part of the hexagram where a man must not try to bring about unity by force because it just makes the horse run farther and farther away. But this is the key here. If it's one's own horse, one can safely let it go. It will come back of its own accord. So too, when someone who belongs with us is momentarily estranged, he will return of his own accord. Will here, it turns out, he has that good in him. He is aligned with them and not with the UHC. So she did push, but it didn't end in disaster because of that goodness within him.
Okay, let's go to chapter 65.
All right. So in chapter 65, Robin goes to Norwich with the UHC and Emily goes missing.
So the epigraph reads, "The line is yielding and stands between two strong lines. It can be compared to a woman who's lost her veil and is consequently exposed to attack." And that's from hexagram 63 after completion.
My first thought is that this is talking about Robin answering to her real name. She's lost the veil of Rowena and is exposed now. She's compromised. But I also think about Emily. The fact that she started to leave but couldn't follow through puts her in a really dangerous situation because she would have been severely punished had Robin not been there to come up with a cover for her. So she's also exposed to attack. But I'm wondering if there's something more here with the two strong lines that will help explain it better.
I think you're right in what this is about. They are both definitely exposed here. The line thing is talking about in the hexagram, the changing yin, the broken line in the second place, which is the bottom trigram, the middle. Mm-hmm. So that trigram represents the middle daughter. And so it's this changing line is coded as feminine. I think in this context, it's about, yes, these women who are stuck between these solid lines, the yang, the masculine threats and control of Wei Sentayo. But the hexagram notes that though the woman is exposed, the attacks will not harm her because she is correct. It counsels patience and waiting. So I think this actually might be a little hint that Robin makes the right choice here in staying. She's exposed, but if she waits, her veil will return and she can complete her mission.
It really hit me for the first time when it says that Robin felt even lonelier knowing that Strike had been so close. It just makes me realize that probably everyone at Chapman Farm feels so lonely. You know, they're surrounded by so many people every day, but none of them have any real human connection.
And now I'm thinking, we're going to get to it in a little bit, but now I'm just thinking about Emily and that person who she was in the relationship with. That's just, it's so sad.
It is pretty depressing. Let's focus on how cute it is that Robin felt this way because Strike was so near. I mean, obviously she misses him.
No, really?
Yeah.
Oh, this is brand new information. I don't know how to deal with this.
Did anyone expect Strike to tell Robin about Charlotte's death in his next letter?
I want to say that my thoughts were that it would distract her from the case if he told her.
Yeah.
You know, and of course she would have questions. She'd want to talk to him. So I think it makes sense that he kept it from her here.
I think you're right, Kenz. I don't think he'd want her worrying about him when she needs to focus on what she's there to do. Because I think he knows full well that she would be worrying about him and that she might even leave for his sake instead of her own.
And he's probably like, the news will keep. It can wait however long until she comes out.
Here's the line I mentioned a couple episodes ago. It says, she too thought back to the two seaside towns they'd visited together in the course of previous investigations, especially the dinner in Whitstable. The white coral on the mantelpiece set against slate-colored walls and the sight of Strike laughing opposite her, framed against a window through which she watched the sea turning indigo in the fading light. First point about the, yeah. We need a side break.
Right.
First point about this has to, again, be how romantic a scene Robin is setting here with this, probably not even realizing that she's doing it. I know we just talked about this in the last episode, but I just still wonder if this is a precedent being set about seaside visits. It gives me hope.
My goodness, you are so not helping with keeping my expectations in check for book 8, Lindsay. Oh my goodness.
I know.
I hear you though. This description is very romantic sounding. And it does sound like there may be hope for a Whitstable 2.0 moment in the future.
I know. I'm sorry. Let's just say it's going to be a very business-like trip to Sark. Lots of murder. Nothing romantic.
At all.
That'll be what we're telling ourselves. But
I mean, that's what I'm expecting. I'm expecting that to be where Murphy's taking her. I'm still putting my money on that.
I don't know if this will matter much to you, but J.K. Rowling did like a tweet that said, I've been wanting something to take Strike and Robin away for a case together. So
Fingers crossed. I would love it.
Like I said before, I don't think Murphy's important enough
to warrant a header.
Also, yet another in-book parallel between Strike and Robin, where they both think about the same thing, just one chapter in between. Strike thought about that time in Whitstable at the end of 63, and now here we are at the beginning of 65.
I really like the details that they both remember here and how specific they are, because they both think about how they laughed together. That's their strongest memory. And they both associate the color blue with the evening. For Strike, it's Robin's shirt, and for Robin, it's the sea turning indigo behind Strike. So they both frame each other in blue, which, as we've discussed at length, is a color.
It is a color.
A significant color. An important color, one might say.
You have been anticipating book eight. I guess I've been thinking much further ahead. I'm sure people have speculated about, you know, when they get married, where it's going to take place. And I apologize if you've already sort of brought this up about the seaside in Cornwall. But I was reading this in the last few days. It just hit me. I'm just like, I can see them getting married at the seaside in Cornwall so that essentially Joan, maybe Ted, this is a little bit sad, but also happy, can attend the wedding with the sea behind them. Anyway, I'm getting all mushy and romantic here and a little ahead of myself.
That's okay. That's what
mushy,
we do.
Mushy, romantic, and a little ahead of ourselves is the motto of the podcast. So yeah. I think you're good.
We should put that on the website.
Put it on the website along with all the other mottos.
Yeah, I'm going to spend a lot of time thinking about that. Definitely.
I'm totally here for the associations with the color blue.
I mean, the color blue is in weddings.
Is it?
Something borrowed, something blue.
Oh my God. You've just blown my mind.
Okay.
She already has her something blue. It's Strike.
Cormoran. Yeah.
Yeah.
Also notice this line. Luckily, Robin's tiredness curtailed the tendency to dwell on or analyze the feelings these memories evoked. I'm getting the feeling that maybe we don't see this happen for Robin as much as it actually does. Mm-hmm. Calling it a tendency to dwell on her feelings from these memories indicates it happens more than we see. Would you agree?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And now I'm curious what other thoughts she has about him and her feelings for him when we're not privy to her monologue, right?
Yes, please. But no, I agree. Remember in Career of Evil where Strike said, of course he does, about not wanting her back. And she filed it away in her mental box to pore over later when she was alone.
Oh, yeah.
That happens a lot, I think. And the frequency with which we see her trying to stop is indicative of how much more often she actually does this or wants to do this.
Lindsay, to go back to your point a moment ago, that line you read, luckily Robin's tiredness curtailed a tendency, but I think there's a way in which her tiredness lowered her guard, her resistance to these thoughts and brought them on. Maybe she's telling herself that her tiredness curtailed the tendency to dwell on them. But in fact, in her fatigue, they drift into her conscious thought, but they're always there.
I think it says that somewhere, maybe Troubled Blood, that her tiredness lowered her defenses. I think it was in, was it in Leamington Spa?
I think it was, because she was pretty tired in Leamington Spa. And that was a chapter where she saw the lookalike in the thing. And
Yeah.
The lookalike in the thing.
Mm-hmm. We know what you meant.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm fascinated, endlessly fascinated by the boundaries of Robin's conscious and unconscious thoughts about him and how she's policing them or not. And of course, this is all going to come to a head now.
She's failing so hard at falling out of love with him.
You know, Robin is good at a great many things, but falling out of love with Cormoran Strike is not one of them.
Not so much.
You know, in the same way that Strike needed to reach that place of self-awareness and acceptance in this book, Robin needs to do the same thing.
Yes.
In acknowledging and accepting her heart rather than trying to fight her heart or control it. She needs to listen to the advice of my doppelganger, Catherine Kent, who said that the heart wants what the heart wants. Or I'm sorry, as she phrases it, the heart has its reasons, which reasons don't know, including random capitalization, punctuation errors there. So, yeah, Ken's still not over it.
I was about to say, I can tell you are not over it.
Not over it.
I never thought we'd turn to Catherine Kent for romantic advice, but here we are.
Here we are in desperate times.
Stranger things have happened.
Desperate times must call for desperate measures.
She's a serious writer.
Very serious writer. A few things happen over the next few paragraphs. We learn Robin really wants to try and befriend Emily after reading Strike's interview with the Heatons. So Robin is chosen to go with a group into Norwich to collect money, and then she's told to change into a new white tracksuit.
And Robin realizes that this means they've entered the season of the drowned prophet.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah, I was excited about this just because I had always anticipated that we'd see Robin leave after the drowned prophet's manifestation. So I felt like we were getting closer.
The prospect of which was terrible. terrifying. Mm. I mean, we'd heard about how terrifying these previous manifestations had been, and it seemed obvious that that was going to be the point at which the shit was really going to hit the fan.
Oh, yeah.
You know, hey, this is a small point, but it's really remarkable how well Joe balances the comic and the tragic moments in this novel. And partly it's a result of, and you guys have been pointing this out, weaving together Strike and Robin's chapters, right? And then seeing those connections. And there's a, well, there's a yin yang to that. There's also the subplot of the two Franks, which delights me to no end. And Barclay's comments about them, they're so wonderfully entertaining, but it's carefully done. I want to say it's why this story moves so quickly and effectively. Maybe not quickly, but really it keeps moving. It's effortless. Here's a little small illustration. That entertaining scene at the Heatons, right? Coming in all its awkwardness and comic horribleness, coming just before the season of the Drowned Prophet, right? When you know we've been led to see and that we're going to have this palpable increase of dramatic tension. And like you said, Lindsay, you called it, right? That she's going to make her perilous escape during this period.
I think in addition to the pace of the story, I think we as readers need this sort of back and forth to escape momentarily from the hell of Chapman Farm, just to take a breath before we're dumped back into it, right? And I mean, speaking of the balance of tragic and comic, The Running Grave is both the funniest and at the same time the darkest, most brutal book in the series, because the amount of humor that we get, it's deliberate because it's commensurate with the level of darkness and misery that we get. They balance each other out. It's a really good writing technique that helps the reader live through the cult scenes where otherwise we might die.
I think I probably let out an audible groan when I saw that Tayo was back.
Ugh, yeah. The bit about him looking like he'd washed his hair for once made me laugh. Because, like, one, Snape, take notes. Then I realized that maybe he's making a special effort for Rowena, and I was right back to gagging, because gross.
Yeah, ew, gross. Imagine special effort being washing your hair.
Right?
It was especially gross when he put his hand on the back of her neck. It just, hang on, I just need to visualize Strike hitting him in the head for a second, just to feel better.
That's my happy moment. I just center myself, and I think about Strike swinging the wire cutters at his face, and yeah. I just feel a sense of peace and completeness with the universe.
It exactly. Must be emphasized that they are foot-long wire cutters.
Yeah.
These are not tweezers. These are, he gets it.
These
good.
Are big.
I will say, though, I was so relieved when he tells her that he was going to wait for her to go to him for spirit bonding.
I remember thinking, oh, thank God, that's at least bought her some time.
I know.
I was just more nervous at this because, like, how long is he really going to wait? Obviously, yeah, it's a guilt trip manipulation tactic. What's he going to escalate to when it doesn't immediately work the way he's expecting it to? I don't want to see it.
It was still time, though.
Yeah.
And it was just enough time.
Just barely.
Robin felt a surge of elation. She was as excited about seeing the outside world again as she'd have been boarding a plane to a fabulous holiday.
Anyone else wanting her to just run for it, even though we know she can't and won't yet?
Yes. Like, please, girl, get the hell out of there and don't look back.
I know.
There's this paragraph here where it says that Robin was appreciating for the first time just how much bravery it took for Kevin to leave the UHC. Because, you know, he had been there since he was 3 and didn't know literally anything about the outside world.
I feel like the more I read this book, the sadder I feel about Kevin, who is someone that we don't ever actually really meet. It's just so tragic given how brave and intelligent he clearly was. Mm-hmm. Kind of reminds me of Morehouse a bit. That same thing where it just feels extra sad, where there's so much potential and what ifs about someone's life. I mean, Kevin could have gone on to be someone who helped so many people recover from situations like this. It's just really sad.
It really is.
And just like with Morehouse, the fact that he figured out too much on his own is the reason why someone had to silence both of them, you know?
Oh, you're right.
Can I just imagine some sort of afterlife situation where Morehouse and Kevin are friends? Maybe they can haunt Gus and Abigail in prison sometimes for fun.
Well, yeah, it sure beats twiddling your thumbs for eternity, right?
It sure does. Yeah.
Everyone needs a hobby.
There you go.
If this was a Shakespeare play, you'd get your wish. They would definitely come back and be haunting their murderers. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, listening to you guys, well, today, but also in previous episodes, you've really helped me appreciate Kevin more. He's come off the page for me in ways that he hadn't before.
You don't really see it until you sit and think about, like Robin does, what it would take. Like, you don't see just how impressive he was.
And it makes it more tragic when he's gone.
It really does, yeah. I also just want to take a small second to roll my eyes at Tayo for not helping carry anything when they set up this stall.
Right.
I mean, this guy thinks he's like a prince or something. I really hope he struggles in prison.
Is it awful that the thought of him suffering in prison fills me with glee?
No. I'm right there with you.
Good. Okay.
He'll have to join that group that we talked about before. You know, the one with people in prison by Strike and Robin.
Oh, right. The support group.
Support group. Yeah. Yeah.
Robin ends up working at the stall with Vivian.
Yeah. I remember hating this at first because, like Robin, I had wanted her to be free to move around, if only to feel a slight sense of freedom. Mm-hmm. But second, I mean, being stuck with Vivian cannot be fun.
Like Vivian. She's a mean girl.
Yeah, I guess it's not all bad because she does gossip to Robin about Emily, and we learn about how she fell in love with that man in Birmingham.
If we're ranking people that we desperately want to have a happy ending in this book, Emily's got to be right there at the top for me, because a whole life spent in this cult, clearly desperately unhappy and wanting to leave. She lost her brother and was forced to betray him by accusing him of something that I think we realize in this was not true. Her sister became Becca.
Yeah.
So there's no family there. And then add on this heartbreaking betrayal by the man she's fallen in love with. I hope that she gets out and writes a tell-all memoir that sells like absolute hotcakes. Makes her $1 million, sets her up for life, does the talk show circuit, meets Oprah or whatever the English equivalent of Oprah is. The queen, I don't know. The English equivalent of Oprah is the queen.
Okay.
The important bit about this, though, is that Emily told this man the truth about Dayu. And it says she told the guy a ton of lies that made him question his faith. And he ended up talking to a church elder about it, which is why she got relocated to Chapman Farm.
I know we've talked about this before, but this really reminds me of that one man who, as a teenager in the Warren Jeffs FLDS cult, ended up turning on his girlfriend, not in a vindictive way, but because he thought he was doing what was right. I think that this is probably the same thing. It's why I feel compassion for this guy, Emily's boyfriend or whatever, because I feel like he probably fell in love with her too. He was just too afraid. He just couldn't shake the belief.
Maybe once the church goes up in flames, Emily and this guy can reunite and sort through their stuff.
Next, we get a whole fangirling session where Vivian talks about Jonathan Wace. Look, I have no room to talk about fangirling, but this one, not so much. Don't understand.
I like to think that we draw the line at fangirling manipulative, narcissistic rapists.
Sure. Yes.
I'm not a fan of those.
No, we're not.
That's correct.
There's a lot of stuff that happens here at the end. And the first thing is that Robin responds to her actual name.
Oh, I was filled with dread instantly.
Yeah.
What did you guys think about the story about her sister wanting to call her Robin after Robin Hood?
Oh, that one made me groan and cringe all at the same time, because like it felt like a bit of a lame excuse. Mm. And I just remember like hoping and praying that Vivian wouldn't think anything of it.
I know. Mm. It's kind of funny because earlier we were trying to make a connection with Little John and Robin Hood. And then here she mentions Robin Hood.
I was just hoping, I had such contempt for Vivian that I was just kind of hoping that she would buy it.
Yeah. Like she's so dumb. Maybe this will work.
So manipulable.
Yeah.
And then the chapter ends with Tayo coming running to tell them that Emily is missing.
I had so hoped that no one would find her and that Strike would get to her and help her on the outside, you know?
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting that people are so free to leave whenever they want and the cult's not a prison, but then someone walks away on a field trip and suddenly it's a full-on panicked manhunt to drag her down and drag her back onto the minibus.
Mm, interesting.
So weird.
I mean, luckily we know she's going to get out soon.
Yeah, it's just under 10 weeks now because this chapter happens on June 30th and the farm is raided in like early mid-September. So hang in there, Emily.
It's a birthday present to us. When the farm gets raided.
Sure. I think it might actually get raided very near your birthday.
Yeah.
Because Strike Fan says it's possibly September 10th.
Only a day away.
Yeah.
All right. Should we go to chapter 66?
Okay. So in chapter 66, Robin finds Emily and gets information out of her about Becca and Dayu. So the epigraph for this chapter, decrease combined with sincerity. It furthers one to undertake something. How is this to be carried out? One may use two small bowls for the sacrifice. And that is from hexagram 41, decrease.
Do you think that the two small bowls here are directly referencing the two collecting tins? The one Robin has that she opens and takes money out to put into Emily's almost empty one?
Oh, that's a really neat interpretation of that image. I like it. I like it a lot.
But in general, it furthers Robin to undertake the burden of helping Emily. It causes her a lot of trouble later on. A lot. But it's crucial when Emily later confides in her.
Absolutely.
The theme of the hexagram is that of decrease below and increase above. That is, the person at the top benefits from the losses of the person below. And the hexagram explores how this transfer of, it says wealth in the hexagram, but I assume the transfer of anything, can be accomplished without that entire social structure collapsing because the bottom is so weak. And I think that this is particularly relevant to the thoughts that Robin has about how she could help Emily escape, but it would put her, Robin, at great risk. And she chooses not to do this and brings Emily back into the cult. But it's clear that this action, though possibly exposing Emily to more harm in the short term, serves the larger good, both for Emily and for the world as a whole. The hexagram says, to render true service of lasting value to another, one must serve him without relinquishing oneself. And Robin helps Emily here. She does help her, that she doesn't expose herself to the greater danger. Well, she does a little, but not to the greater danger of helping her escape.
You saying exchanging wealth, though, is interesting because literally, they do. They literally do.
We start off the chapter seeing Vivian just completely losing her mind over Emily being missing.
I love the comparison to a mother who has lost her toddler because I immediately understand the kind of panic Vivian is displaying, but it's weird.
It is weird. Vivian says, what if she's gone DV? As if that's the nightmare, worst case scenario. Mm-hmm. And it's not because she's worried about Emily's individual soul or well-being, right? It's because someone leaving the cult is a threat to the cult itself. Someone rejecting it is an attack because it undermines the absolute authority and moral correctness that the UHC holds itself up as. Emily going DV is an existential threat to the group and thus to Vivian herself, which is why she panics so much.
And then we go back to that, the sense of insecurity that the individual feels, and that's why they're drawn to the cult in the first place. Mm-hmm. So when someone says no or leaves, it moves that person psychologically back to that point of vulnerability and insecurity, right? Because, oh my gosh, like who could possibly reject this? It's fulfilling me. It's satisfying me. It's giving me everything I want.
It shakes that sort of newfound identity.
I can't say this about a lot of cult chapters, but this one's kind of exciting in a fun way. I was so excited for Robin to get the chance to run around on her own.
The rush of freedom I felt vicariously. Mm-hmm. On her behalf, the moment she's out of view, I'm like, she's free.
Robin is free.
She has given the suck.
It was almost immediately taken away, though, when Robin starts panicking and hearing Strike in her head about how two very dangerous things have happened recently to compromise her undercover identity. So mm-hmm. One, Lynn seeing her in the woods and now answering to her real name. I just feel like even though I know what happens already, I still feel kind of worried that this is going to somehow change and her cover is going to be blown while she's there, you know?
Like, what if the book changes?
I know. I
love that experience. Yeah.
What do you think would have happened if they would have discovered who she really was while she was still in their control?
Honestly, I can't decide. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't have allowed her to leave. But if they'd held her against her will, then surely they'd know that they'd be in a world of trouble for actual kidnapping. When her partner comes looking for her, or when she manages to escape, which has to be considered as a possibility, I still don't know that they would have outright killed her because we never see the church murder someone specifically to prevent them from leaving.
I mean, I feel like they killed Deirdre, let the pool take care of it, and letting Jacob starve.
They definitely did cause those deaths, 100%, but I feel like it wasn't to prevent escape specifically. Like for Deirdre, it was a punishment that went too far. They seem to have intended to bring her back like they did with Robin. Like it's a thing they do. It just failed. And with Jacob, I mean, it's just, you know, the basic fucked upness. It's up in the air, though, because, they could have decided to kill Robin.
Yeah,
I don't know.
I just think of both of those deaths as murders. Well, so it's just the reason for it would be different. I think they're totally capable.
Robin will say later that she can picture Jonathan Wace, mm-hmm. Pulling the trigger with tears in his eyes, right?
Yeah. When Robin thought about how tempting it was to go call Pat and say she needed to be picked up, but then immediately thinking that the job was still unfinished, I was begging Robin in my head, just please go call Pat, please, knowing full well that it couldn't happen.
I wish I could say that knowing it kept us from wanting it.
Yeah, it does not.
Okay, so speaking of her needing to stay, it says, I got to stay, she told the strike in her head, and I know you would too if you were me. Robin closed her eyes for a moment or two, exhausted and hungry, and among the disconnected thoughts sliding through her mind was, and there's Ryan. Ryan, whom she thought about far less than Strike these days, But that, surely, was because she was so focused on the job. It was natural, inevitable.
First of all, Robin, stop lying to yourself. This is what I mean about Robin repeating past mistakes, just like Strike did. In Ink Black Heart, we see her saying that she had to stop lying to herself when she admitted that she was in love with him. And now here she's doing it again.
Yeah.
Maybe she will actually stop lying to herself in the next book.
I mean, that's what I'm thinking. Yeah. I'm not fully sure I understand what she's saying about Murphy. It almost sounds like Ryan is part of her reason to stay.
I thought that Ryan floated through her mind as another sort of argument for why she should leave, but that little thought was so late and had so little power over her that the thought of Ryan had zero sway on her decision.
I think the thought of Ryan does make her want to stay in a weird way. Not the becoming a permanent cult member would be preferable to being with him necessarily.
I would take Ryan over this cult.
Sure.
I'm not gonna lie.
Of course.
That is very level-headed of you. But in the sense that she wants to forestall having to think through why she's in this relationship, maybe in that sense. The thought of Ryan does make her want to stay in a weird way.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. Avoidance.
Robin is queen of avoidant behavior. She is deeply avoidant. The cult is it's a temporary hiding place from this dilemma that she knows she's in. Because while she's here, she can completely excuse all of her non-feelings for Ryan because it's the job.
Yeah.
I feel like if she hadn't gone undercover, she and Ryan might have already broken up by this time because he might have pushed for more commitment than she really wanted with him. And she might have been forced to and have the bandwidth to do some actual soul searching on the topic.
Maybe.
This just occurred to me. Okay, so he's going to say, you know, being away from you has led me to think I love you. So I wonder if, not that I really disagree with your point, Pools, but I'm just sort of saying, I'm thinking counterintuitively, or I'm trying to think through the other way, right? And so maybe being in the cult, being away, is bringing it to a head faster, right? Forcing him to say, I love you, which is going to force her to soul searching about why she responded automatically, but doesn't really think that she does.
Yeah, maybe for him, the cult was like the test of their relationship that they weathered so well, and it's made them stronger. It's not the case for Robin. It worked that way for the man she's actually in love with.
But it hasn't been. She's going to have to recognize this, like, right? That all the way through with the letters, she's like, oh yeah, and I forgot to leave Ryan a note. And there's Ryan's note and all that. That's the reality that she's, right?
The skill she has at lying to herself and refusing to acknowledge her own feelings is baffling to me.
I'm fascinated with the boundary between her conscious and unconscious thoughts about Strike.
Yeah, it's amazing to me.
Next, there's this part where Robin says, what? Because she sees the newspaper. It turns out to be Brexit, but I thought she was seeing news about Charlotte.
Yeah, that was my first thought too. It was like, oh shit.
Yeah.
Her level of shock at seeing this news is funny to me. She actually stops her very important search to pull out the paper and read about Brexit. And I think it demonstrates how isolated she's really been because she has missed these months of escalating propaganda. So for her, Brexit actually succeeding came out of nowhere. She must feel like she's suddenly been plunged into like some alternate bizarro universe where this actually happened.
Yeah, it has to be pretty jarring.
As somebody who's been away, you know, when it was in the Navy for 4 months at a time and to come back to news and all and people's lives to restart like that, it's exactly an alternate bizarro.
It's like, experience. What the hell did I miss?
Yes.
Here's where Robin walks around and then she finally finds Emily in a toy shop.
So we know that Emily wanted to come to escape. And I'm just so glad that Robin was the one who found her. Because imagine how much trouble she would have been if it had been anyone else.
Oh, for sure. Because she would have been in deep shit if she'd been found by anybody else, especially someone like Vivian.
Oh, God.
In this bit, when Emily tells Robin what she had to do to Tayo to let her come to Norwich. Mm-hmm. First of all, I want to kill him.
Same. We're all there.
Second of all, so the way she describes the act, she doesn't know the word blowjob. She's not sure that Robin will know what she's talking about. It really strikes me that she has zero frame of reference for sexual relationships outside of the horror that is the retreat rooms.
Yeah, right? I know. That really stood out to me too.
This poor woman. Ugh.
Totally change gears though. Just a fun
Thank
little
you.
Side note. Yeah. It says that Robin and Emily are speaking in front of Sylvanian families' toys. I figured that they were toys since they're in a toy store. So I Googled them. I know these toys, but here we call them calico critters. I found out that it's because in 93, Tommy, the brand, lost the rights to the name in the US and Canada. So they had to reintroduce them under a different name. I just thought that was cool. Having worked at a toy store for so many years, full picture of this conversation here with these
Interesting.
Toys.
I find it so appropriate and heartbreaking that it's this display that Emily's fixed on, because it is this pastoral, ideal, beautiful, cute little image of a family, parents and children together in their little houses. It's what Emily lost so early on and then lost again when she was dragged away from the man she loved in Birmingham and what they could have been. She talks about how they're all these tiny little flesh objects, materialist possessions, but you can see that there's a longing within her for this.
Yeah, Emily and Kevin are just killing me on this reread with how sad it is.
Oh, yeah.
Up until this point, I wasn't really sure if Emily believed in all the UHC stuff, because we've seen her talk about the truth about Dayu, but it is clear from this conversation that she does believe in most of it, or at least enough to believe that she's close to reaching pure spirit and she wouldn't survive on the outside, you know?
We also get horrible foreshadowing for Robin's time in the box here, because Emily says she'll have to go in the box and explains that it's for when you've been really bad.
I remember thinking, I do not want to find out what this is about, and knowing that I probably would.
Yeah, there's a definite sense of foreboding after hearing about that.
Oh, what's in the box?
I know. I was nervous about Robin helping Emily, although I knew she needed to gain her trust, but I was still nervous.
It's a really smart strategic move. Like, Robin is clearly thinking through the possibilities here of what she needs to do. But I do also believe that a little part of her is helping just out of compassion, because she sees how terrified Emily is. She wants to spare her pain. And
yeah, of course, that's
whatever
Robin.
Whatever the hell the box is. Yeah, that is Robin.
The only thing I can think Robin should have been more careful about was how much money she gave to Emily. It seems like she put way too much.
I was screaming at her. I'm like, just put enough in to bump her up to acceptable without giving away the game. You're making it too obvious, Robin. You're being too nice.
I know.
Oh,
yeah.
Like the epigraph the hexagram warns about gave herself away.
The conversation does move to Dayu, and we are getting so close to the information that Emily has, but we're still not quite there.
I think this conversation is also really feeding the Becca is really Dayu red herring when Emily tells Robin that Becca just isn't the same person after she came back from Birmingham. You know, have we talked about this theory? Did anyone believe it?
100% did. Yes. It felt like a little clue. It felt like one of those clues where I don't pick up on it and then later I'm facepalming myself. It was exactly that.
Except now we're facepalming because we fell for it.
I'm literally never going to outsmart J.K. Rowling.
Here's a bit I really liked. It says, "I want to scream the truth, but that's ego motivity." "It isn't ego motivity to tell the truth," said Robin. "You shouldn't talk like that," said Emily on a hiccup. "That's how I got relocated. I joined the church to find truth," said Robin. "If it's just another place where you can't tell it, I don't want to stay." So I really love this exchange because it definitely adds to my thinking that truth is a major theme in the book. But it also makes me laugh that Robin said she joined the church to find truth, because she's not lying. That is exactly why she joined the UHC. It's kind of funny.
Nice.
This conversation is pure Robin. This is not Rowena talking. This is what Robin genuinely believes. She's connecting to Emily as herself with one of her most fundamental core values.
"But there is truth," said Robin firmly. "It's not all opinions or memories. There is truth. I know that this is all UHC stuff, but I can't help but think of Strike thinking about Charlotte's lies and the truth between Strike and Robin."
This belief that there is an objective truth, that it can be found and it's important, that it's worth seeking out and knowing for its own sake. This is the core that Strike and Robin share. It's what connects them. And Robin's firmness here feels like, I don't know, like she's reaching out to hold Strike's hand on like the metaphysical plane. Like spiritually reaching out to hold his hand for strength.
It very much parallels Strike talking to Philippa and Nicholas to me about truth.
Yeah, very much an echo.
But also, Robin being the one to say that there is truth when she just lied to herself earlier in the chapter about her feelings. And, oh, it's only natural to think of Strike more. It just feels significant to me. We got to get there with Robin.
Yes, that's right. If you guys remember, I argued in the essay I wrote for your blog, all mystery stories more or less expect the reader to play the detective, to search for the truth, right? To solve the case. But beyond the conventional question of who done it, the Running Grave seems to me to raise these deeper questions, these epistemological questions, meaning the problem of knowledge. How do we know things? What do you know? How do you know that about the world, about other people, about ideologies and religions, about our origins, right? I mean, there's a lot of this book is talking about the themes of paternity and birth, but above all, that big unknowable truth, right? The undiscovered country of death.
Yeah. And like, what's the answer? How do we know? For Strike and Robin, it's with each other and refusing to stop searching, but also understanding that there are some things that are beyond that, and they just have to trust in their love.
Yeah, and the heart knows. There's a way in which the heart knows, it's a non-rational form of knowing. And yes, you guys are going to, I'm sure, talk about this when you get to the chapter, right? When Robin just knows he's there. How does she know that? Who of us would argue that she does? And of course, she's proven right.
Yeah. The heart has its reasons. Which right. reasons?
Oh, thank you, Catherine.
Whatever,
Kent.
Blah, blah, blah. I can't even remember the quote.
Yeah.
The chapter ends with Emily trying to help Robin avoid spirit bonding with Tayo by telling her that she just needs to go with Jonathan Wace.
We all know this isn't actually helpful to Robin, but it was encouraging to me because it's a clear sign that Robin gained some of Emily's trust.
And thank fuck for that.
Good stuff. Wow.
Well, thank you so much, Kurt.
Thank you so much. It's been great. And, you know, it's always fun to be with you guys. It's always enlightening and illuminating. And I hope we can do it again.
All right, Ken. So what are we doing next time?
All right. Next time we are doing chapter 67 through 70. And in those chapters, Strike speaks with Jacob Messenger, Jonathan Wace visits the farm, and then Robin encounters Jang while investigating the hatchet in the tree.
Ooh, hatchet in the tree.
It's a lot of cult stuff. We're going to need to prepare some.
It's a lot of cult stuff. We will have to come up with some cult chapter cleanse. Yes.
Yeah. Like a Strelicott smoothie.
I would love a Strelicott smoothie.
That'll do it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoy what you've heard, don't forget to follow us on social media. We're on Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr at the SE Files Pod. You can also contact us on our website at thesefilespod.com. or email us directly at sefilespodcast@gmail.com. Thank you so much again for listening, and we hope to catch you next time for another episode of the Strike and Ellicott Files.